Okay, welcome to the latest installment of the Balanced Webinar Series. This is Introduction to Psychedelics as Medicine. Psychedelics as a great building block on the journey to heal and find our authentic self. I am your host, Ben Greenzweig. I am the founder of Balanced, which can be found at balancedtrail.com that provides knowledge to the psychedelic curious. I'm also the co-founder and CEO of Momentum Events. And for those of you that don't know, Balanced Trail was designed by myself after my own experience with mental health and psychedelics to provide knowledge for those that are curious to potentially go on a psychedelic journey. We don't push a decision. We don't push a medicine. We just provide the books, resources, TED Talks, videos that I find valuable on my journey for others. So enough about me. It's my pleasure to introduce my very good friend, Frank. Frank, tell us, how are you doing today?
Oh, hi, Ben. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you for the opportunity. It has been a great day so far.
Excellent. Well, we find ourselves here still in the midst of our pandemic or pandemic response, and the news just keeps on coming that the mental health toll to our society continues to be extracted at a very high price. Data today came out that Cook County, Illinois, had a 40% increase in opioid deaths in the month of May. And all of this, of course, traces back to some major mental health foundational flaws or challenges that many people experience on a daily basis. And depression and anxiety and panic attacks are definitely part of it. And I know that this is something that you had battled as well. So Frank, why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your story and let's kind of hear the beginning. So why don't you start?
All right, let's do it. So, and feel free to ask me questions, okay, Ben here. But, you know, I'm actually from Brazil. And for as long as I remember, I always suffered with some level of anxiety. And it's funny that I don't know if there's a particular term that describes it. I've heard before the term high functioning anxiety, meaning that I actually always did very well in school and at the workplace, but maybe the cost of it would be extremely anxious about everything. So there would be very few moments in which I would not be on my head, you know, like thinking about what would be the possibilities of something that was about to happen in the future, and usually the negative possibilities of what was about to happen. It's kind of like a what could go wrong, right?
And high functioning, and, yeah,
exactly. But at the same time, I could work really well. I could do things really well. I could be like, you know, a very productive member of society, right? Like if you measure your value based on that, which I don't anymore, but I think I did in the past, and maybe that's what caused part of my anxiety, is that a lot of my value, a lot of my identity, a lot of my sense of worth would come from, like, you know, how productive I could be. And then I would be extremely productive, but very anxious about being productive. And then it would become like a little bit of a vicious cycle over there.
Yep.
And I think because of that, you know, like I ended up being drawn in a lot of ways to situations, both academically and professionally, that would be very demanding, that I'll need to be on all the time and I'll have to deliver it a lot. I would need to be kind of like, you know, always be concerned about having a top performance. So I started my career doing investment banking, actually, which I think was
talking about a vicious cycle.
Right. In a lot of ways, would be a perfect fit for that particular game that I was playing, right, unintentionally on my mind. Right. It was not a choice, but it was happening. There was a pattern that was happening over there of having to be the top performer always, being incredibly worried about what others would be thinking about me, constantly seeking for validation, and that promoting a lot of anxiety and stress because so many things could go wrong in that particular regard. And then I feel that when I was working investment banking, you know, like I very quickly became the top analyst. I was delivering a lot of value, but you know, like I think my body started to giving me signs that whole thing was unsustainable. So
I'm going to pause right there. How? Because sure. Maybe there are people who are listening
right,
who don't know what those symptoms are for them. So what kind of symptoms are you getting?
Yeah, so it's funny that looking back, I didn't really give a lot of importance to those, but looking back, I should have. But you know, like I was working super hard. I was super stressed all the time. I was working, you know, 16, 70 hours per day, including weekends. So there would be no weekends. It was like a really crazy schedule. So I started to lose my appetite a little bit. So was not, and it was funny because it was not even something that I was suffering with. I just, you know, gradually started to lose my appetite and not eating as much. And then I also started not to be able to sleep a lot, which was kind of bizarre to me because I was working so hard that before any chance that I would have to sleep, I would sleep. But then at some point I just couldn't really sleep because I couldn't turn off my head. Right. And,
yes.
And then
I called that with my mother, the committee of all the people right, in your brain good. That are talking exactly. Nonstop. Can't shut them up.
You keep like debriefing about the situation yes, within the committee. That's exactly what it is like, yep. Ben. So then it started like that, and then I think because of those two factors, I started to feel sick, very constantly. So either you know like feeling that there's something wrong with like my stomach, or like you know having these massive headaches, or just like feeling weak or like feeling kind of like, or catching like a flu or something. That's very consolating. I never get sick, right? Like, you know, never get sick. And then I started to feel sick very constantly. But again, like I was still like ignoring those symptoms and I kept pushing further, you know, and that lasted like, you know, for a good, like, you know, handful of months. And then until I got to a particular body sign that I couldn't ignore, and then let me tell a little bit of the story of that. Like, you know, I was working on a very important deal during a week. So I think during that whole week from Monday to Friday, I might have slept maybe like 12 hours total, like the combination of all the days. And then on Friday the deal went through. And then, you know, like I was really praised. So I was really happy about it. Okay, like just finished that. So what I'm going to do right now is just, I'm just going to go home and slept through the whole weekend, which had happened before, right? Asleep, just
right.
Mission accomplished. Let me go. and then I went home. I fell asleep almost immediately. And then I think maybe 2 or 3 hours later, I woke up very scared. My heart was beating so quickly. You know, I felt that I was having some kind of like a heart attack. I couldn't breathe and I couldn't really articulate my ideas really well. So I really felt that I was having a heart attack at that point.
Wow.
And I didn't really know what to do. I remember the first thing that came to my mind was like, you know, calling my girlfriend at the time and like, hey, I need to go to a hospital right now. I'm dying. Like I'm having a heart attack, like I'm dying. It's like I didn't know what to do. And not only there was the physical symptoms, but my emotional side was a mess. I was like, you know, very, very scared. It was like, you know, I just didn't know what to do. And then
for someone who's had some anxiety, now you're going through this, your anxiety must be jacked up to 11 at this point, because you're anxious about being this anxious as well.
Exactly. It's again, like it becomes like a build-up effect, right? Because yes. you're scared because of what you're feeling in your body and not to know what to do and then thinking about the worst possible outcome of it. So it's exactly how you put it. So I went to the hospital, right? And then over there, you know, I did all these exams and then, you know, like I was sure that there was something really wrong with me. And then the doctor came back and said, like, there's actually not really nothing wrong with you. Like you're a bit dehydrated because probably was, again, as I said, I was not really drinking water or right. eating properly. But other than that, you're fine. You had a panic attack. And then my initial reaction to it was like, I don't have panic attacks. You don't really know because this doesn't happen to me. You don't understand.
I don't get panic attacks. I love it.
Yeah, like this is not something that happens to me. Like, you know, I always saw myself almost like as a machine, as a tank. Like I can bear through anything. But that is exactly what happened. And what followed that panic attack is that I got into a very deep state of depression. You know, I remember the following days after that. I just, you know, had the sensation of like, you know, I cannot get out of my bed. Like, you know, I just don't have energy of getting out of my bed. And then anything that I would think about the future So the anxiety still was still there, but on top of the anxiety, there was this kind of catastrophic, you know, potential outcomes of everything that I would do, and everything would be a disaster. So,
let me cut you off right there, because yeah. I've talked a lot about depression, and the word that I use is hopelessness. So not only do you feel that things aren't good, but you have a sense that they'll never get good again. Is that what you experience?
Exactly. And on some level, like, there's nothing that you can do about it, right? Because one thing is, I think, is being sad, and like, you know, being sad is you can be sad, but you still feel the energy, you still feel that there's a way, you still feel that you can do something about it, even though you're sad in the moment. But that point in time was, I think, like hopelessness, and then there's nothing I can do other than just laying here. So it's a complete withdrawal from the situation. Right. Like, I just don't want to engage with anything, because anything that I'll do is going to be terrible, you know?
So on that note, did you ever have feelings like this prior, but were more isolated and you didn't know, like, did you almost see, like, pardon the expression, green shoots of this attitude when you were younger, as a child, teenager, and you didn't understand, or you didn't know what kind of box to put it in, or is this a completely new sensation for you?
No, it was not. I think the magnitude of that, I think, was new. Just, I think, especially because of the whole panic attack, I think my body and my mind was putting such a limit that it basically had to reboot or shut down, or whatever you call it. And remember that I was telling you before about, like, ignoring some of the signals that my body was giving. Luckily, I didn't ignore that one. Probably the following one would be like an actual heart attack, or like an AVC or something like that, because my body and my mind was, like, being put on the limit. I think that before, when I look back into my lifetime, I had those feelings in many different occasions, and then maybe never to that magnitude, but I had those feelings before. And I don't think, I didn't know how to label them. I didn't know that I could ask or look for help in any of those. And more fundamentally, I think for most of my life, I dealt with those feelings with the sensation of guilt that, okay, there's something wrong with me. I'm feeling sad, or I'm feeling down, or I'm feeling that, you know, that I'm withdrawing from the situations because there's something wrong with me. So I'll put more pressure on myself. Okay, I need to stand up and do something, you know, which was very counterproductive before.
So would you classify this as your rock bottom?
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. Was a put it down moment.
So getting help is a whole other chapter. Realizing that you couldn't fix this yourself was probably a sobering moment. Talk us through how you came to realize that this is not going to be something that you're going to be able to fix yourself.
Yeah, so I think that's a good question, Ben. And then part of it is that, you know, like, when you hit like the rock bottom, or if you go really low, there is this thing, especially for someone with my personality, that I thought that I could go through anything and I could take anything. Being able to recognize that really took a very, very low point of me, like, you know, really not knowing how I'll do like some basic things, like, you know, like how I'm gonna go and like get food right now, you know, like how I'm gonna go back to work. You know, like some basic functioning of like an OR, and like going across the street to go to the post office was like a terrifying thought. So very basic things that I have to do that would involve any other people or getting out of my home was virtually impossible to do. You know, like I needed to have support, and then I rely a lot on my family and some of my friends in that moment in time. But you know, like for me, the perception of like how much help I needed to do very basic things, like, you know, going out on the street at that moment, was a very strong sign that okay, like I need help, you know, like I need like maybe like more professional help, or like something bigger than just having the help from friends and family, which was already a first step, right?
being willing to ask for help.
From family and friends, you know?
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that help. So what did you, were you prescribed? What did you try?
Right.
Talk to us about the journey of getting help.
Yeah, so that's good. So, you know, I was in this very low point, which in the first time of my life open a window of me looking at my life. I was like, there might be something wrong here that I need to address, right? It was the first time that I was able to even ask myself that question. And then by asking myself this question, it's like, okay, I might need some help with some aspects of my life. One immediate thing was actually, you know, like taking anti-anxiety and antidepressant drugs, which I did for about like, you know, 2 or 2.5 years. And, you know, like, I think at that point in time, they were really important to get out of the hole sort of deal. I think it was like in a very low point. So
I've equated them to really good first aid. You don't want to walk your life with a Band-Aid for a major wound. But if you have to seal it up to get to the hospital, that's what you do.
Exactly. And but then the thing is that I thought like, okay, I cannot keep taking this drug, so I need to find something else. At that point in time, then my perception was that all my life was great. There was nothing really wrong with it. The only thing that was off is that I had to find a way to manage my anxiety and my stress. That was the whole problem. So if I found a way to manage my anxiety and my stress well, I can go back and do everything, and everything is going to be fine. That was my initial assessment, right?
So going to the symptoms, not the disease.
Exactly. So when I was looking for help, I always started to test it out, like, you know, a couple of alternatives that would help me to manage my anxiety and stress. So, you know, I tested a couple of things, like, you know, more mystical things, more like, you know, Western science based things, you know, like, because I've been always overly rational, the more traditional type of talk therapy would have, I always felt that that was a little bit, would take me to a point, but not further, because I would understand why I was doing certain things, but then it was very hard to change my behavior and change my emotions. It would happen, but it would be a very slow process. And then from all the things that I've tried, I ended up finding this particular line of body work and meditation that really resonated with me. If you ask me why that was the case, I cannot really tell you. For me, part of my journey is that not trying to fully understand why that works. It's just kind of
accepting. Oh, I know that worked.
Yeah, but you know, like, I find this particular type of therapy that is called, like, you know, bioenergetic therapy, that basically, you know, has this concept that we all live lives of emotional suppression since childhood, and those suppressions, they materialize themselves in our physical body, and they create emotional patterns. So you do some physical exercise to try to release that, basically.
So Frank, for the audience that's curious to learn a little more about bioenergetics, where do you recommend they start to get some good knowledge on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of resources online. I mean, like, most of the big cities, they're gonna have a couple of bioenergetic therapists or a bioenergetic center. You can look on Google. A lot of the work on bioenergetics is based on an author called Alexander Lowen. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the modern bioenergetics based on this particular author. So, you know, if you want to learn a little bit more, you can take a look at that.
And to those that are listening, I will put some of those resources on the balancedtrail.com website. So please stay tuned and check back there for more information. So, okay, so we'll get back. So bioenergetics, you don't know why, but it spoke to you, and it was trying to manage your symptoms, right? That's kind of really where you were working on.
Exactly. That's how it started, right? But then, by doing this particular type of therapy, and there's another thing that I was doing, which is a type of meditation that is, no, it's called like active meditation, which is a type of meditation that there's a lot of emotional expression. There is physical movement. There is dancing. You know, there's a guy named Osho that created some of these active meditations, that I was doing a lot of them. And then by doing the active meditations and the bioenergetic exercises, it became really, really clear to me, Ben, that, you know, like, the as you mentioned, the anxiety and the stress, they're just a byproduct of something else. There is, you know, they're like a symptom or something deep. And that something deep was related to some of the patterns of behavior that I learned to develop over my life, and the mismatch between those patterns of behaviors and who I really am and what is my authentic self.
So I'm going to pause you right there, because there are people that are going to be listening, and they're going to say, well, how do I know if my behaviors, my mental health behaviors, are related to the way that I was taught or learned or designed from years back. What clicked in your mind that enabled you to realize that, hey, there's something deeper going on here?
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I have the perfect answer for that.
That's acceptable.
Right? Because in the end, I think we're just having like these layers and layers. So even I cannot really tell you what I'm really like. I don't really know. I'm just constantly clearing the layers and believing that I'm getting closer.
That's
but
awesome.
One of the things that was a very strong indicator to me was actually being able to feel more. And one of the things that really that there was a really strong sign that I was having a pattern versus something that was closer to me was my ability to feel, like having more of an emotional range. So my ability to feel any kind of emotion, not only like, you know, kind of happiness, but even like sadness and like anger, anything, was very limited, because I think I was basically almost like running a software on my brain, which was the pattern, just reacting to a situation, not based on who I was, but based on the software. And that software was fairly emotionless. Or even if there was emotion, the emotion it felt a little bit robotic and artificial, you know? And then
through the motions, as some would say.
You'll say that again?
You were just going through the motions of life.
Yeah, exactly. It's just autopilot, kind of like, you know, that artificial. And then when I was doing some of the exercises, and then after some of these exercises and meditations, I would feel more in whatever direction that was. And then even, you know, kind of initially not even knowing how to handle those feelings. And then I started to believe that, okay, like I'm not really sure where I want to go, but if I could use a compass, the compass would be my emotions telling me kind of the direction of what is really making me feel something. And if right. I am feeling something, there's something there to explore further.
So putting this together for audience here, so clearly you had what you felt was just a situational, circumstantial, mental health battle. When you didn't really find any sustained healing, you began to question and dive deeper. And you had this inflection point where you just realized that you were going through the motions and there is something flawed maybe in the software, not in the hardware, but right. You had to go work on the software. You needed a reset. You needed to really get to these root causes. Is that a good summary to get us?
Yeah, I think it's a great summary, right? And then again, unfortunately, you know, like I think most of us, maybe all of us, most of the softwares that we have are not the ones that we chose to install. They were put there. We learn unintentionally, right? Like we just developed those over our life, and they're running, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So let's talk about how you were gonna, let's see, control alt delete or upload some new software. What would you say you were on a mission to do?
Yeah, I mean, like in the end of the day, right? Like, you know, the mission became less about controlling my anxiety and stress, and more about, okay, what I'm really like, who I am here, and then believing that the closer that I could get to who I am, I could feel more, and because I could feel more, I could have a more fulfilling life. Because one of the things that for me was always really big in my life is that my struggle, my limitations in terms of connecting with others. And now it's obvious to me why that was a struggle, because I had like such a limited emotional range. I was basically on autopilot for most of the time. I was almost like, you know, this machine-like individual. Mm-hmm. So how are you going to connect with others if you don't show your true, like, you know, humane self, or your true human emotions over there? How can you connect with others without being minimally vulnerable and minimally open? And I was not. So for me, the whole thing became, oh, what are the things that I can do to promote my authentic self further? How do I find who I am, and how do I remove some of the barriers and constraints and the fears that I have in terms of just being who I am and just, you know, expressing myself or feeling what I need to feel.
So let's talk about psychedelics. Right. How did you determine that this is the pathway for you to go, and what did you ultimately choose and why?
Yeah, so that's good. You know, like in this journey, you know, that has been you know, like that I started in 2007, 2008, you know, like I started to go deeper and deeper into that. So not only exploring more of this particular types of meditations and body work that I still do today, and they're super important and they really speak to me, but I started to find, you know, like other ways, you know, like other ways to, you know, to move my body, to understand what I am, other spiritual practices. And then to be honest, for a big part of my life, I had a lot of prejudice in what regards psychedelics. I think for two reasons. One, that it felt that it was something wrong, right? Like that is like,
right,
why would I do that? The other thing, Ben, that I had a fear before actually trying psychedelics is that, well, if I take psychedelics, I might impair my ability of, you know, meditate and reaching higher states of consciousness without taking anything. So maybe right. If I take it, then I'm going to, I develop this ability and now I'm going to lose this ability. So it was something that I had a little bit of a prejudice, you know?
So a different kind of fear, because some people I talk to have a fear that they're going to, you know, have a bad trip, although there's a lot of discussion on what a bad trip, if a bad trip actually exists, but that's a different conversation.
Correct.
You were worried that you would lose elements of, even though you weren't 100% happy with who you were, mm-hmm. You didn't want to lose some of those elements regardless.
Exactly. And I think about like, well, I did a lot of this work. I you know, at any point in time during this journey, including today, at any point in time, I can look back and say, okay, I'm better than I was before. And then at any point in time, I can look forward and say, wow, there's a lot of work to do. So I was a little bit afraid, Ben, of losing part of what I conquered or part of what I developed, you know, like during the journey by psychedelics. Then okay, now I'll need psychedelics to do anything. I like everything that I built, I'm gonna lose it.
Right.
Yeah. So
okay. So talk our audience through your research process. Let's cut to the end part and just come back because it's going to be a fascinating part of the story. What did you ultimately experience? Which type of psychedelic or empathogen?
So I did two, actually. I had two experiences. The first one, which was about three years ago, was with Iboga. Mm-hmm. And the last one, which was about 1 year ago, was with psilocybin.
And for those of you that are listening, there's information about both on the website. Iboga is from Africa, of course. Ayahuasca, certainly more in the American, Central American, Southern, South American continent as well. And then, of course, psilocybin tends to grow in many places, including the Netherlands, as well as here in the U.S. and stateside, among other places. So just giving some geographic information for our audience here. So Iboga, okay. So talk to me a little about that experience.
Yeah. So the beginning of it, you know, the first one with Iboga was it all came from someone who used to do the same types of therapy and the same type of body work and meditation. So it's a person who I really trust and was really close to me. And she had an experience with Iboga and with a group that she thought was really good, like in terms of the whole concept of like set and setting. And, you know, like really having a strong preparation, this feeling that these people know what they're doing, like, you know, really leading you in a good way to have a great experience. And then right after she had the experience, she came to me and said, like, I had one of the most amazing experiences of my life taking Iboga. And I thought of you like many, many times, you should consider doing it. And it was funny, right? Because like, you know, I think very few people would like I would listen to very few people in that particular regard, but I think I really listened to her and I got really curious about it, and then I started to learn a little bit more. So I started to, you know, like read some of the resources that I'll find online, and then I reached out to this particular organization that organized this particular retreat, and then I thought that there was one coming that I could make, you know, 3 months from that particular date. So I signed up, and one of the things that I really like is that the level of preparation that they would do, like a pre-retreat, like both in terms of like, oh, really recommending you to have a specific type of diet, like kind of like trying to clean your body right before doing that. But also there was a lot of writing involved in terms of writing about your life, writing about some of the things that you experienced, some of the things that you aspire to be, some of the things that you think that stand in either way. So like, I didn't know that back then, but like, you know, if I think about that now, that was a very good way to really set the stage and put you in the right mindset to have that particular experience.
So talk the audience through, and we're not going to go into detail here, it's not the point of these conversations, but talk the audience a little bit through what revelations, what revealed itself to you with either or both journeys? I think that's always a burning question people have.
Yeah. For me, those two experiences, even though they were different in many aspects, in terms of the types of insights and what they brought to me, I think they're more similar than different. So the first one, I believe that the two main things that came out of it and that lasted with me for long and are still in me. I can still feel it. I can still remember those moments and how I got these insights. The first one was a matter of how I got to the understanding that I was living a life that was completely disconnected from nature. So you know, like there was no elements of nature in my life at all. You know, like and then it's funny that's something that as a child I really loved, and then when I became a teenager, like an adult, I completely neglected. It was something that was even annoying to me in terms of being, you know, like, why you want to be in nature? It doesn't make any sense. Right. So part of it was giving me that standpoint of like, okay, I'm really disconnected from nature, and this can be a big part of my life, and I should try to find ways to reconnect. And I'm glad that I did that, because that has been a great source of energy and just like a relaxation and insight for me, like being more in nature. The second thing on this first experience was related to questioning how open and vulnerable I was. Mm-hmm. I always thought of myself as being someone very open-minded, very vulnerable, but the reality is that it was more like a selectively open-mindedness, meaning that I would, you know, I'll be open until the point that I would not question some core beliefs. If things would question a very core belief, I'll not really go there. You know?
Just open enough, we would say.
Yeah, just open until the point that it's not that uncomfortable. So right. So then when it becomes uncomfortable, I'm not gonna touch it. So that was really good, because then I think because of that experience, it led to some other experiences, including the psilocybin experience, in terms of just me being a little bit more open to, I don't need to know the right answer for everything. I can keep, you know, having experiences, and then the experiences are valid by themselves versus they have to be valid because of a specific outcome. You know, so having that openness, and then I don't need to understand it. I can have like an amazing experience and feel what I feel without having to understand or describe the outcome to someone. You
know? So let's talk a little bit about afterwards. Okay, so you've gone through this journey twice. You had certain revelations about yourself, which you allowed yourself to do. So let's go back to the analogy we had at the start of this conversation, or the middle of the conversation, your hardware and your software. So what state is your software in, and how did that interact with the life you've come back to?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that, you know, like really resonated with me. You know, like as I said, there was this first experience. The second experience, I feel that was a little bit more concrete in certain aspects. I stopped smoking after I took psilocybin, for instance. Like I just
was that an intention? Smoke. Did you put that intention out?
It was not.
Had no urge. You had no taste. Explain. When you say you just stopped, what stopped? The craving?
Yeah, I mean, like for years, I was actually, you know, reducing how much I was smoking. So I reduced to a certain level, but I couldn't reduce that further. I didn't have, to be honest, an explicit goal of had that being an outcome of the workshop, but I just didn't have the craving of smoking anymore. Also, you know, like I feel that after these two experiences, both my appetite changed a little bit, and my alcohol consumption really faded away. Was not even an intention, like, oh, I'm gonna stop drinking, but now, like, you know, I barely drink, and I think part of what faded was just some of the insights and reconnection that I had over there, and how the alcohol, in a lot of ways for me, was a way to feel more comfortable and deal with some traces that I still have of anxiety, you know. So
So that's interesting, because obviously there's a lot of success rates in clinical trials of psychedelics for addiction, smoking. There are some studies, and again, links to the studies on the website, balancedpill.com, but there are links to some studies that peg smoking cessation at 80% success rate. Some are a little bit lower. There's early positive signs on drug addiction, crack addiction, cocaine addiction. So the fact that that was an unintended consequence, and to your alcohol consumption point, would it be safe to say that maybe the alcohol was numbing that inner dialogue that consciously or subconsciously didn't want to come out? And when you released it or confronted it, there was nothing really to numb.
I think that's true, right? And the alcohol is a little bit funny, that aspect, because it numbs you, but for me at least, then on the following day, it would really trigger, you know, all kinds of anxiety-related responses. So it was a
quintessential depressant that it's hard to get.
Exactly. So you know, those just faded. And then another thing that I felt that really changed, going back to the software and hardware, is a lot of the software that was kind of on my head was related to not trusting others and trying to always focus on how I was different from others. And one of the biggest gifts, especially from the second experience that I had with psilocybin, was this enhanced capability of seeing myself as part of a more collective experience and trying to look into others and look into people who are around me and focusing more on what brings us closer and what makes us the same versus what makes us different. You know, so this element of being able to connect to others, and then this kind of new software in terms of let me focus first on what we are the same, and usually what we're different is a very, very small part of it. It doesn't mean that it doesn't have to be addressed. It doesn't mean that you don't need to deal with it, but it's so much easier to deal with it in a way that you're seeing what bring us closer, to see that we're sharing an experience, and then just deal with that particular thing without completely denying the other person or labeling the other person based on what is different or what you disagree with. I feel that made wonders, that was really wonderful in how that improved my relationship with my family, how that improved how close I am with my friends, how I feel that I can fall in love more frequently and more deeply with romantic partners. It has been a big, big part of the experience.
So we're gonna kind of glide towards our closing here. And Frank, it's been an unbelievable pleasure hearing this journey, and one that I've heard so many times and I never grow tired of hearing about it. Let's kind of end with advice. Those that are listening, whether it's 100, 1,000, 10,000 people, whatever it winds up becoming, what kind of advice would you give the average Jane, the average Frank, the average Ben? What kind of advice would you give on whether or not they should consider psychedelics as a way to help manage their mental health ailment?
Yeah, I think I think it's hard to try something different. It's gonna touch you kind of in a deep way. It's hard to wait until you feel fully prepared and with absolutely no fears or anything around it. I think my advice would be try to find something to do the first step that is uncomfortable, but is uncomfortable enough to make a difference, but it's not that uncomfortable that you cannot handle it. You know, you don't want to do that big of a step that you're going to feel in a panic mode, but you want to feel a little bit stretched. It needs to be something that feels like a little bit of a stretch, you know, and whatever it takes to get to that point. And a lot of times what takes to get to that point is talking to some other people who did it, read. There are so many good books for me. Reading, for instance, how you change your you change your mind was a big thing. In terms of reading something like that, researching, starting with small dosages, whatever it takes. Depends on what is your constraint. How can you mitigate it so it's just kind of uncomfortable enough? But you're never gonna be able to move if you're waiting for perfect comfort That's just not going to happen.
You know, Frank, I can't tell you how much I relate and appreciate your words. You know, part of what I found about my own challenges and journey was that I was always looking for a sure thing, a guarantee. And it's an unbelievable, terrifying, and liberating position when you realize that in life there are no guarantees on anything. You can pretty much so only count on that you will have control over what you think. Sometimes, not even all the time. So there are no guarantees on anything in life. And I think that's a phenomenal realization and strong advice for our audience when they're on this journey that you want proof. You know, it's funny, people's religious beliefs, of course, vary tremendously. But, you know, the great quote from Corinthians, we live by faith, not by sight. It doesn't need to be applied in a religious perspective. It can be applied with psychedelics. It can be applied with mental health. If you wait to see to believe, you might never believe, right, Frank?
Exactly. And to be honest, right, like, you know, it's not my job to convince anyone, but the reality is that the downside, what you can lose on it, is very little, if nothing. If you find the right way to do it, if you prepare yourself, if you do that, with people that you trust, worst case scenario is just not going to speak to you, then you can just move on and find something else, right? So,
well, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it's a great way to bring us to a close, which is certainly myself, through my experience with MDMA for my depression, anxiety, and PTSD, I made a vow to not proselytize, just try to live a better life. Right. Clearly, that's your perspective as well. Frank, I want to thank you so much for being so raw, so open with your story here. For balance, our goal again is to provide knowledge for those who are psychedelic curious. This conversation we made available. We're making all of our podcasts available for free, given the state of the world right now. So Anchor FM, it'll be uploaded shortly, and people can listen at their leisure. But I want to thank you so much again for your time, and I want to give you the closing words.
Thank you, Ben. This was a pleasure to share a little bit of my story here. I really appreciate the space, and to everyone else who might be listening to this, it's hard to think about something that is going to be more important, more fulfilling to you than finding who you really are and being able to behave in a way that is closer to it. And then I think psychedelics, like some many other alternatives, can be a good way to do it. So if you can go for it, if you can find the comfort to try it out, that can lead you to some great things. So I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Frank. Take care. Thank you so much, everyone. And we'll see you on the next installment of the Balanced Webinar Series. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you.